Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this is, we're in the first few days, almost the first week of our winter retreat here. Just starting to settle in with our full group schedule. Morning, evening puja, morning practice periods, afternoon practice periods. And just taking a moment to reflect on this opportunity. Nine months of the year, you know, we're pretty much engaged in a daily schedule with various engagements, activities, work in the mornings. Lots of visitors, overnight guests. And of course, we still maintain our practice of meditation and developing the qualities of monastic routine, monastic life throughout the year with that goal of you know, working towards a continuity of practice, no matter what we're doing, no matter what the schedule is, no matter what we're engaged in. But nevertheless, the 3 months of the winter retreat is a very a special time, chance for us to deepen the formal aspects of meditation, settle into a bit quieter lifestyle for a few months, engaging less, setting down formal work projects, creating a bit of an environment of stability. The generous offerings of the winter retreat crew who have come to help us out, their primary objective being to serve the winter retreat, to make it possible for those of us who live here and work here to settle back for a period of time. So just to take that moment, this moment here, to express gratitude for the service that the winter retreat crew has come to offer, and of course to also participate in the retreat as well. But yeah, it's a special opportunity for the residents here to sink into a bit of more of a quiet space, cultivating a sense of stillness, the winter being a good time to do that with what is usually wet, cool weather to help us turn inwards, but not this year so far, except for a little bit today. But still the signs of the forest as being somewhat quiet, that's also conducive to this turning inwards, developing a sense of refuge with an interior quality to it. So this is kind of a transition period right now, these first few days, first week, 2 weeks of practice. And we pick up a structure of an all-day schedule to help facilitate that, to give us a bit of discipline, structure around that, to help contain the energy from the year. And it's good time to also notice what it's like to be in that transition. People have different preferences for group practice or for solitude. And so throughout the winter retreat, we have a varying schedule. It will change every now and then, sometimes more structure, sometimes less structure, sometimes no structure. And it's really good to note how the mind reacts to that, because everybody does have differences in their preferences, their personal preferences. Some people really love group structure because it's difficult to be creating one's own structure sometimes. The defilements of mind that we all have sometimes get the better of us, and having a group structure can be quite useful in containing that. So some people find themselves very much appreciating that and very much attracted to it. Others who have a personal preference for no structure might feel a bit of resistance to having sitting and walking periods according to a bell throughout the day. So whatever, you know, the proclivity of the mind is to be aware of that, just to notice that. And it'll change when we move into less structured periods, then those who like the structure will find themselves disappointed, and those who prefer the solitude will find themselves feeling more satisfied or more happy. But again, to notice, just to notice that when one is getting what one wants in terms of a structure, the sense, what does it feel like? When you don't get what you want, when you have to put up with a situation that doesn't feel comfortable, that pushes your boundaries, pushes your edges, what is that like? And just to realize that freedom, peace, isn't found in a particular structure or a particular mode, that it's in learning how to be content with what it is that you find yourself in at that point in time. So that eventually it doesn't really matter what the structure is or what the structure isn't. The ability to practice, to be content in any situation is the goal of the training. So just to notice where we're at right now with that. Similarly, along this, the change of activity, there's a dampening down of activity. People who prefer to have a quiet, not so much work, more slow pace, are probably in the midst of really enjoying this this time, kind of moving into a very simple, non-engaged mode of operation. Maybe people who are used to lots of activity and appreciate stimulation or work are finding it a bit difficult to settle down. Maybe some still the becoming urge to be involved in certain projects or tasks or different ways that you can see the mind moving out and maybe engaging in things that you think you should do, or you know, just ways of distracting the mind from moving into to more quiet. So again, watching and knowing the effect that this change in routine is having on those preferences. We all have a few duties to do during the retreat, the monastic community. So just to notice the effect of having still a few duties, you know, the morning chores, the participation in dishwashing roster, And watch the mind. Is it saying too much work, not enough time for myself? Why am I scheduled to be on this three times in the next 2 weeks, and somebody else has got two times in the next 2 weeks? Just to notice the mind as it resists any particular tasks of engagement, or the opposite, clamors for more. All of these little structures, different ways of scheduling work, meditation, daily routine, are opportunities to just see where the mind moves. I think you know, with this opportunity of winter retreat, and as time goes on, the focus in the meditation practice will shift a bit from what it is during the year. You know, we're always encouraged to make contemplation, meditation practice a significant part of our daily life, even when we're engaged in work activities, engagement with the public. The focus is in maintaining a lifestyle that's conducive to the contemplative side of our practice as well. The quality of it will vary when there's more activity during the regular part of the year, and we find ourselves maybe focusing on different kinds of aspects of the mindfulness practice. Our tradition strongly encourages mindfulness of the body, developing a sense of body awareness, body contemplation, anapanasati, contemplation of the different aspects of the body, grounding ourselves in awareness in the body, using it as a real focus, as a real tool for development of awareness, development of mindfulness. And that goes on through our retreat period as well, the body being a strong grounding force in our contemplation. Also, with the encouragement towards developing more stillness of mind, we naturally turn towards awareness of the more subtle aspects of experience, such as the contemplation of the mind. And that's kind of where I've been finding myself starting to turn towards in the past few days. And it's useful to have maybe to recollect a structure that gives some support for that contemplation of mind. And of course, my attention turns a bit towards the Anapanasati practice, Anapanasati Sutta, the particularly starting to look more deeply in relation to the third tetrad, the contemplation of mind, using the breathing process to course through an investigation of the properties and qualities of mind, and developing those. So using that just as a brief format for a few reflections this evening, beginning with that first step in that grouping of contemplations, with the breathing always as the base, using the breath to modulate our investigation, always using it as a point of reference, to breathing in, experiencing the mind. And what does that mean? Just beginning to look at the qualities of mind. Oftentimes, particularly in the starting periods of a retreat, we find conceptual thought, when we're sitting in meditation or walking meditation, conceptual thought is very prominent, all conditioned by the amount of talking, conversation, mental activity, thinking that that we do throughout the year. When we put a bit of structure around our speech so that we're not engaging as much with others, that doesn't stop the mental process. So thinking starts to come to the fore as we sit down. The momentum is strong in that realm. So there's a lot of proliferation sometimes, a lot of just kind of the ongoing nattering of the mind that likes to hear itself go on and on. And it's important not to get lost in aversion to that, because it's just a natural consequence, something to be expected as an experience in meditation practice, not something to feel like has to be squelched or suppressed or repressed or obliterated, but just realizing that it's a, you know, it's the vipaka, the result of our daily lives, and that that's going to be the nature of the mind, at least to some extent, as we start to settle down. Not to fight it, but to know it, get to observe it, and to understand it, and to realize that it's kind of a surface manifestation of what's going on in the mind, and that the layers of the mind, the qualitative experiences of the mind are deeper than that surface chattering that goes on when we sit down and get quiet. And without resistance or trying to force the mind to be quiet, just to slowly turn the attention to what's happening a little bit lower down in the awareness. It's underlying that experience of the chattering mind. And I think that's what it's referred to in experiencing the mind, is looking at those more subtle layers. When you see descriptions of it, say just in the Satipatthana, you know, you realize that the Buddha is pointing to qualities of mind, qualities like is the mind experiencing lust, or is it absent of lust, experiencing aversion, or absent of aversion, experiencing delusion, or is there an absence of delusion? So pointing towards these qualities of mind rather than just the surface manifestations. Is the mind contracted or is it distracted? Other qualities of mind, concentrated, not concentrated, various qualities like that. So it's getting to see the affective tone of mind as we quiet down, as we explore what it is, what is happening inside. And realizing that the conceptual process is woven in with those experiences, those affective qualities. The conceptual mind will proliferate based on what particular state of mind is underlying the experience. It will expand on it, will reinforce it, will keep it going, and support it if it's left unchecked, if there's no awareness of that process happening. Conditions the mind. So the task becomes to, without resistance or aversion, But a bit of polite firmness to set aside the attention being on the actual thinking process, to gently turn one's attention towards those affective qualities. And the best way to do that, as we all have heard many times, is through really experiencing the body and the effect of certain affective states within the bodily experience. So it involves using all of that work we've done in developing body awareness to really investigate how the affective states of the mind are manifesting within the bodily experience. A real useful way of exploring this in meditation, as everybody is familiar with, but becomes more apparent during periods of quietude like this, especially in the beginning, is the contemplation of the hindrances. The hindrances, sometimes we think of them as sort of conceptual experiences, but they really are part of that contemplation of mind. They're affective experiences. And to start exploring them in that light, I think, is really useful. And pretty much if you're sitting in meditation and the mind isn't settling down into a nice, calm, clear, peaceful state of mind, then there's likely one or more hindrances at operation. And it's very useful to start to tune into that as a frame of reference for contemplation, bringing to mind what the possibilities are, scanning through the different hindrances and asking yourself, what's present here? What's the quality of mind like? What hindrance seems to be occurring? And the Buddha offers a number of similes that are very useful descriptors of the experience of the hindrances, the experience on an affective level, on the level of body. The descriptions that he offers are quite distinct and useful. So the hindrance of the first hindrance in the list of sensual desire. He likening the mind itself to a clear pool of water. That's the base of the mind being like a very clear, still pool of water, freshness, clarity, luminosity, but with this natural quality of reflectiveness. So water can take on different properties and look different depending on what's present in it. So if we're talking about the hindrances and the hindrance of sensual desire comes up, then there's the simile of dye being poured into the water and coloring the water. And you can see that in, when there's gross manifestations of sensual desire, there's this tendency to see things in a different way than what they really are. We color our experience based on the wish for, desire for a sensual experience. So the most obvious example is when we fool ourselves and see, exaggerate the attractive features of a particular object just to satisfy that wish for sensual stimulation. So it's like looking through tinted glasses. We see things the way we want to see them in a different color from what they naturally are. We avoid seeing the unattractive features. We skip over those, see things the way we want to. So this is like, you know, the old phrase, looks like looking through rose-colored glasses. We see it the way we want to, tinted, but not clear. You get lost in it. And there's that kind of dreamy quality that sometimes we can get involved with in sensual desire. It's really you know, can be a pleasant experience to indulge in some sort of sensuality, or even in the mental conception of a sensual experience. It's easy to kind of sink into that and allow ourselves to get lost into that. It's the hindrance of sensuality, sensual desire. Getting to know that as it happens is the first step in working with them, seeing it clearly. The hindrance of ill will, the Buddha likens to boiling water, and you can really see that in the particularly the gross manifestations of ill will, the fire rising up, the heat, the boiling sense, the agitation. It's a very affective experience in the body, very unpleasant, something that we don't like at all, and will almost do anything to get rid of it, usually striking out at the object that is causing it, thinking that somehow if we annihilate the object that is at the cause of the ill will, then somehow that will alleviate the pain. Not realizing that in the long run that just reinforces that kind of reaction. That very uncomfortable boiling sensation we try to get rid of in any way we can. So the hindrance of the third hindrance of sloth, torpor, where we just sink into very dull states of mind, if not out and out nodding off. Not uncommon at all, particularly during the first period of retreat. The mind has mind and body have been going on engagement full on, and there's a certain sense of the mind shutting down as it makes its adjustment into more of a quiet retreat mode. Even if there's not a lot of activity that would cause one to normally be fatigued, just that change where there's not nearly as much stimulation can sometimes lead to this intense dullness and nodding off. So being aware of that, if that's arising. The simile that the Buddha offers in terms of the water similes for that would be a pool of water that's covered over with scum or algae, so that there's water in there, but it can't be penetrated. There's a heaviness, a thickness in the experience. Very descriptive of that thick, dull, scummy state of mind. So using that as a reflective tool, if you're experiencing that, is that what the mind is like? What does that feel like, investigating that experience? The restless mind, the mind that just doesn't want to sit with it, doesn't want to be sitting still, needs to get up, needs to move. The body is very agitated sometimes, not being able to sit in one position for more than a few minutes without having to move around, not just from physical discomfort, but from mental agitation, restlessness. Oftentimes accompanied by anxiety, proliferative thinking, dissatisfaction, not being contented with where one is at, results in this restless state of mind, like water that's being affected by the wind. There's ripples across the water. The wind keeps on blowing. The water's agitated, churning, unable to be still. The fifth hindrance, to meditation practice of doubt with the simile of cloudy, muddy water, not being able to see clearly, filled with thoughts of, well, should I be here? Maybe this really isn't the place for me to be. Maybe I've undertaken something that isn't really right, even in its extremes. Maybe questioning the validity of the teachings, thinking that maybe one should be pursuing some other spiritual path or no spiritual path at all. When the hindrance of doubt is in full sway, just not being able to see clearly, having lost that sense of interest and faith in the teachings. So these are paradigms to use to investigate when we're sitting in meditation and we're not having a clear, peaceful experience. Well, let's investigate the cause. Let's investigate what's the underlying quality of mind that's going on in the form of a hindrance. And throughout the year, we work with antidotes, specific antidotes to the hindrances, just as a manner of practice, because most of us have various levels of experience and with these different hindrances. So, just as a routine way of dealing with them up front, as an ongoing practice, we'll incorporate some of the practices of, say, a subhakamatana, contemplation of the unattractiveness of the body to counteract the lustful states of mind. We can work developing practices of kunti, patience, compassion, equanimity in relation to aversion, irritation, states of mind. We develop metta, loving kindness, attitudes of caring and interest for others' welfare, to be able to counteract the tendencies towards aversion and ill will. Practicing with development of energy, as an antidote to sloth and torpor, sense restraint, particularly moderation in eating, as an ongoing antidote to sloth, torpor states of mind. Different techniques to stimulate energy, walking meditation. For restlessness, generally, techniques that help calm and steady the mind, of course, mindfulness of breathing, contemplations that bring up a sense of peace and tranquility and faith and satisfaction to help settle and soothe the mind as an ongoing practice to counteract the tendencies towards restlessness. And then also to develop a sense of appreciation for the path, the teachings, developing familiarity with the teachings, the life story of the Buddha, his quest for enlightenment, remembering our own inspiration for picking up the practice. Why did we pick up this practice in the first place? These are antidotes for the hindrance of doubt. So these are all practices that we do throughout the year and that we can start to pull into more intense practice if we're really overcome with one of the hindrances. Sometimes the hindrances are much subtler than their gross manifestations, and I think that particularly at a time of retreat like this one gets further on in the practice, the hindrances tend to be a bit more subtle than their gross manifestations, but are still obviously there. So maybe there's not out-and-out sensual craving and desire, but little ways that the mind is moved in that realm. Same with little, you know, maybe not out and out bursting anger, but subtle forms of irritation can arise in different ways. The kind of state of mind that comes, say, when you're on the phone, this is obviously one comes to my mind, on the phone with Blue Shield. And you're waiting there with their nice little music going on in the background, and they're saying, "We know your time is important and valuable. We apologize for any inconvenience that it takes while you wait for our assistance. Please hold, and you'll be served within the next, you know, possible time that somebody's available." And 5 minutes goes on, and 10 minutes goes on, and you get these little announcements that repeat exactly the same thing every 2 minutes. And Anthony can attest to this. He was telling me about this experience on Blue Shield the other day, and how he got to the hour mark on hold, and finally there was a clicking and a sound. No, I didn't ask him, but if his mind was like mine, it's thinking, oh, finally, something's going to happen. Somebody's going to come on the line. And then you get disconnected, which is what happened. Did your mind move, Anthony? My mind has moved in those situations. A little irritation arises. Is that, that's a subtler form, maybe not out and out throwing the phone through the window, but a sense of frustration arises. Hindrance of irritation. Or subtle forms of sloth and torpor, maybe not out and out falling asleep, but that sense of dreamy dullness where you're not quite sure. You think maybe you are just calm and peaceful. I was remembering an example of that with somebody I was talking to a few months ago. Young man who was here for a while and who was fairly sure that he was experiencing some very deep states of jhana, and would describe his experiences as being very, very peaceful, very calm, very tranquil, very settled, going for long periods of time, occasional, you know, awareness of little phenomena like lights and different experiences, and I was wondering if he had gotten to fourth jhana. Just talking with him and asking, well, you know, a little bit more about the experience. You know, was there clarity, alertness, awareness of phenomena arising, ceasing, anything like that? No. It was just very peaceful, very calm, not much happening at all. Complete loss of time, and then kind of coming out of it after a long period of time, but without any sense of clarity or insight or much of anything, just kind of a nondescript, very nice, quiet, peaceful experience. And after we explored it for some time, it kind of occurred to me and concluded that actually, it was probably a very subtle state of almost being asleep. So those are easy to get into and can be very pleasant and very dreamy, but there's no clarity, no alertness, no mindfulness, no comprehension going on. So these are more subtle states of you're not falling asleep, you're not keeling over, but there's a sense of lack of clarity and dullness, no matter how peaceful it might seem. A more subtle version of that. And the same with states of restlessness. You may not feel like you have to jump up and run out of the room, but a sense of not rightness, a slight bit of agitation, dissatisfaction, following strains of thought that take you off into different areas, bits of anxiety, planning different things, plotting different things that need to be done. these little forms of more subtle restlessness. And the same with doubt, just a lower grade version of full-on doubt, little niggling questions about whether you should be doing something different, maybe looking to go find something to stimulate, to read, questions about whether what you're doing is right or not, and that doubting mind. So there's various levels of that. And as I was listening to Ajahn Janako do the reading from Ajahn Liam the past couple of days, I was really appreciating Ajahn Liam's description of his encounters with the hindrances over, you know, what apparently seemed like, you know, many years of practice, and how he dealt with them. And of course, I'm sure, you know, he didn't mention them in this particular talk, that he had, you know, worked with the antidotes, as I had described them earlier. But what he was emphasizing, and I think is really applicable to these other subtle layers, is really dealing with them, seeing them in the light of the three characteristics, and not just making a firm resolution over and over again, as he was, to not be moved by them, to see the sensuality or the ill will or the restlessness or the different states of mind as just aspects of experience that one does not need to be moved by any more than any other aspect of experience in the conditioned realm. To see the changing nature of even these hindrances, these subtle forms of hindrances, to stay with them, not believe in them, not see them as substantial issues or problems that have to be reacted to, but just to hold them with a very strong sense of clarity and equanimity, to see the unsatisfactory nature of them, of course, but not to be moved, not to believe in them, and to be able to just, to some extent, bear with, endure, and not push away, not be resistant to, but not buy into, to stay with them with clarity and alertness, but not feel the pressure to have to react or respond to them, to see them as they arise, as they maintain, and as they pass away, even if it takes a while for that process to happen. So this is more of a subtle way of dealing with the hindrances. And each one of them can be dealt with in this way, particularly in their more subtle forms. And I think it's a very useful way of looking at the hindrances and working with those hindrances. And seeing them or experiencing them on that affective level, the experience of the body energy in relation to these hindrances, is really paramount, I think, to using that approach, so that we're not getting lost in the conceptualization of what's going on or the analysis of what's going on. But once the hindrance is recognized, bringing it to the experience of the body, and really focusing on that energetic experience of whatever the hindrance is. Even hindrances like sloth and torpor, which are can be more difficult to experience on the body without sinking into them. If with a level of interest, one can really explore something like the hindrance of sloth and torpor, really looking at the effect of dullness, what does it feel like, what's the state of mind, investigate that, pick it up as an investigation in the body experience, then just the natural response of interest in it will help dispel some of the qualities of the hindrance itself. But to just have the attitude of patience and acceptance and clarity around whatever the hindrance is, and to be determined to just be with it and watch it as it arises and then as it ceases. And to gain some insight from that, to be able to realize that they're not substantial aspects of who we are. They're not ingrained, permanent states of mind, qualities of our personality. That we can't always understand where they come from, the results of past karma, but we can be with them in the present and treat them with a sense of investigation, with curiosity, to see them in their true nature, not to give them any power or authority over the mind, but just to accept them and see them for what they are and then let them go in their own time. So I was really appreciating the readings and his just relentless, firm determination to deal with the obstructions in that way, the kilesa that comes up in the mind, the defilements that come up in the mind, just with that penetrating investigation, that penetrating mindfulness and clarity towards those states of mind. So that's those are some ways of investigating the experience of the mind, that first stage in the contemplation of mind. The second stage of that practice, breathing in, gladdening the mind, breathing out, gladdening the mind, is a step that we can pull into our meditation experience as well, particularly as the hindrances might settle down, maybe through some mindful and clear awareness of hindrances as part of a meditation period. Things will start to settle down. The mind doesn't become quite so enamored with some of the hindrances, then a sense of more sense of clarity and peacefulness will be there. And it can be a useful time to pick up something that even encourages or pushes the mind further in the direction of relaxing and settling and enjoying the meditation a bit more. By introducing some contemplations that will gladden the mind, whether they're more reflective contemplations, loving kindness again, or investigation of the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha that bring a sense of uplift or joy into the mind. The recollections of generosity, sila practice over the past year in the monastery, things that you know, if you just spend a few minutes contemplating them, will bring a sense of appreciation to the mind, a sense of gladness, of uplift. This is developing the quality of pamoja, easefulness of mind, that serves as a basis for further development of the mind. So these are active contemplations to bring in as the mind settles down and becomes a bit freer from the overt hindrances. So these first two steps in this tetrad are ways of developing the meditation practice, particularly in the first days and weeks of our retreat. Properly and mindfully pursued and attended to, they will naturally lead to more of the development of the third and fourth stages of this part of the practice, the settling into concentration, collectedness of mind, settledness of mind, a sense of deep peace and easefulness will naturally result from that attending towards letting go of the hindrances of cultivating the gentle qualities of mind, the peaceful qualities of gladdening the mind, of softening the mind. That softness and easefulness will naturally settle into a deeper state of concentration. I again really appreciated the way that Ajahn Liam just wove that kind of working with the defilements into using it with the breath as well. And that's something that I've always appreciated about the Thai forest tradition is the way that the anapanasati, the breathing, and the investigation are part of the same process. Samatha and vipassana are not exclusively separate or sequential aspects of meditation practice, that there's not this forced distinction between the two of them. They move together. So using these contemplations, the development of mindfulness, clear comprehension in association with the breathing or other objects that will help soothe and calm the mind and guide the mind. They work together and work in tandem to help just settle this mind into a deeper, more peaceful state of concentration. And then with the potential of freeing the mind, that fourth stage, liberating the mind, referring to at least at this level, at least a temporary liberation of the mind, where there's a sense of freedom from the hindrances, freedom from freedom from any overt kinds of suffering. There's underlying tendencies are still present. They haven't been completely uprooted as in the full liberation of the mind, but there's a freedom that comes from the development of deep states of concentration that one can experience. So these are just some aspects of the practice that I think one starts to turn towards as we move into a 3-month period of more quietude, more focus on the contemplative side of the practice, the settling into different routines over this long period of time with fewer engaged duties. So just to be encouraged, just to encouragement to be patient and to allow the process to happen naturally and gradually and to stretch yourself when you need to, if the mind is moving towards distraction and defilement, to pull it back, to have that kind of firm determination to keep on with the practice, keep on with the routine, use the structure as your container, allow the different structures to act as mirrors for the mind, for the experience, to see where the work needs to be done. And to relax also, to enjoy if things are getting a bit tense and uptight and too goal-oriented, to just step back, look around, appreciate the naturalness of the environment, the beauty of where we live, the natural inclination towards quiet, still, peaceful states of mind by just reflecting on what's around us, and the precious opportunity that we have for the next bit of time to sink as deeply as we can into the practice. So I offer that for tonight's reflection.